arts and cultural activities are critical components for gathering. So now is the time to work with our policymakers to look at what tax benefits can we be looking at, what incentives, what permit expediting and other measures can be taken to reactivate our downtowns with organizations like CounterPulse and anchor those organizations as foundations for healthy multicultural cities and for gathering places where we can gather across all of our differences and have the critical conversations that we need as a country to come back together.
Welcome to Voices of the Community, your source for in-depth discussions on critical issues facing Northern California. Today's episode is part of our continuing special series focused on the resurgence of the arts and culture sector post-COVID-19. Our journey begins with a reflection on the recent State of the Arts Summit, a collaborative effort with Arts for a Better Bay Area. Among the breakout sessions, one topic resonated deeply: affordable housing for our creative workforce. Feedback poured in from summit attendees expressing a desire for more time to explore this pressing issue. In response, we've crafted three follow-up episodes, each delving into key discussions from the summit. One of the other topics that came out of the APA Summit breakout session on affordable housing and real estate is the potential for leveraging the post-pandemic market dynamics to facilitate arts and culture organizations to acquire their own performance spaces. To explore this exciting possibility, we've invited Julie Phelps, Artistic and Executive Director of CounterPulse, and Joshua Simon, Senior Advisor at the Community Arts Stabilization Trust. They'll reveal the innovative real estate model that helped CounterPulse buy their own performance space, a model that could be a game changer for arts communities nationwide. This is Voices of the Community, where dialogue leads to change and every voice matters. I'm joined remotely by CounterPulse's Artistic and Executive Director, Julie Phelps, and by Community Arts Stabilization Trust, also known as CAST, founding board member and now senior advisor, Josh Simon. So welcome back to Voices of the Community, Julie and Josh.
Thank you for having us.
All right. So as a follow-up to your participation in our special series on the arts and culture sector, we wanted to host you again to share with our audience the wonderful creative real estate model that enabled CounterPulse to purchase their building in the Tenderloin neighborhood of San Francisco. So with that, I'm going to start with you, Julie, and have you provide a little background on CounterPulse. And then Josh, turn to you and ask you to provide some background on NCCLF and the creation of the Community Arts Stabilization. So Julie?
CounterPulse is a space, as George said, in the Tenderloin now, but we have an over 30-year history of being in San Francisco and supporting interdisciplinary arts. So we started as an artist collective in a oversized living room on Divisadero Street back in the early 90s, known as 848 Community Space. And then in the early 2000s, we were expanding and growing as an organization, and we moved to the Soma District, where we rebranded and merged with our fiscal sponsor and became CounterPulse. We were there for just over 10 years. This was before the tech boom and before all the condos and high rises started going up. And we, you know, we're coming to the end of our 10-year lease right as Twitter was opening up on the Market Street side of the same block we were on in there in the Soma. So that's when we began shopping around for our next home. And in the early, I guess it was like around 2012 through 2015 is when the kind of CAST model and CounterPulse and CAST partnership was born. So we'll go more into that. But generally speaking, we exist to support emerging and mid-career artists experimenting in their forms, predominantly focused in dance, but also community arts. We have a gallery space, ongoing residencies and co-productions that span devised theater to music.
Great. And Josh?
Sure. Well, the organization that you referred to as NCCLF was Northern California Community Loan Fund, and they have since changed their name to Community Vision, so I'll refer to them as Community Vision. And I was their director of consulting at the time. There was extensive conversations with the city of San Francisco and foundations and arts communities for many years at that time to try to figure out how to keep the arts rooted in San Francisco. Prices were skyrocketing. Groups were being forced out. And Community Vision was working with many organizations to try and find ways to keep them rooted. We were asked by the Reynon Foundation to see if there was a way to work with organizations that are being forced out. And one of the findings that we had in our conversations, many organizations were really good at what they did, but exotic community development finance tools and bizarre tax credits just weren't a common department within small organizations. So essentially, large organizations could take advantage of these kind of tools, but small ones couldn't. So the idea came up to create an organization that could bridge that gap. And so that's how CAST was born. The Reinin Foundation said, gee, if they could give us $1 million a year for 5 years, could we help organizations? And we said, we're given the price of real estate. We couldn't do that. That's a small amount of money to help a lot of organizations, but we could borrow against the 5 years commitment. And that gave us the funding to then reach out to organizations like Counterpulse. Most of the initial organizations we worked with were organizations that Community Vision had already been working with. And Counterpulse really stood out as a great potential partner. The CAST idea was that there are many intermediaries that loan groups money, but there is nobody to act as a real estate partner and to allow the groups to continue doing what they do well while the real estate partner does what they do well, which is put together the partnership. So CAST was created to secure and steward affordable space as a partner and to find ways to keep space anchored in low-income communities.
So CAST, for example, with Counterpulse, you identified the building they're in now on Turk Street, and you purchased the building with them as the... So share with us how that model works, right? So CAST acquires the building, and then Counterpulse leases it. Is that like you would a trust, like a residential trust, where the owner buys the building, if you will, or has a ground lease, and then the trust owns the land? Is it that way, or...
Well, I think the critical word is trust. So the first thing we do is we worked with Counterpulse, as well as a number of other potential organizations to try and help, to build trust first and to work out what our partnership could be and to assess financially where was Counterpulse in terms of its resources and its capacities. So as a gap filler, we tried to fashion a partnership that would match what Counterpulse had and fill in the rest. So Counterpulse was able to provide about 10% for the building. And I should say, this wasn't the only building. We looked at a number of buildings, but decided with Counterpulse that this was the best location for their programming at that time. And so together, we agreed on the building and came up with a partnership where they provided 10% of the resources, and we came up with 90% of the resources. And that went beyond just the money from Reinin Foundation. We looked at other sources, so we leveraged New Markets tax credits. We leveraged other forms of financial tools in order to expand to the full breadth of what Counterpulse had to do. So together we forged into the adventure that is real estate development, which is not for the faint of heart. And I would caution anyone going into a renovation project that it's going to be difficult. So having that foundation of trust and that foundation of communication was critical to those early years.
And then part of that model, Josh, is this 7-year buyback program that you structured with Counterpulse, which allowed Julie and her team 7 years, if you will, to raise the additional, it was what, $7 million, Julie, I think?
The $7 million was Counterpulse's total capital campaign, which included the purchase price of the land, the renovations, and the sort of deal with CAST, but additional resources for Counterpulse just directly, like a wasting endowment to launch and expand programming, because we were moving into a facility that was three times as big as our facility, and we wanted to meet the need of the Tenderloin as good neighbors. And so the capital campaign for just the purchase was more in the range of 5.5, 5.6. And then there were these additional organizational benchmarks.
And go ahead, Josh.
Well, I should say, so our model is we come in as a capacity partner. We put in the amount of money that the two partners agree. And then over time, we get essentially bought out as the, so we've given partner an agreed on period of time to either be able to buy us out or to come to some other agreement. But we do that in partnership. So in this case, the tax credits were a 7-year period. The way the tax credits work is they provide a certain amount of equity in exchange for tax benefits.
Economic development, I guess, yeah.
An economic development tool. But at the end of 7 years, the investor has gotten everything they wanted out of tax benefits. So rather than cast holding on to those benefits, we transfer that value to our partner. And that's the reason for the 7-year period is we all agreed that the 7-year period for the tax credits was also a good period for the fundraising, with the agreement that if CounterPulse needed more time, afterwards we had some contingencies for that.
But the Well, and going back to your question of if it's leased or how it works, so in total, the project spanned more like 10 years with the beginning of this trust building and relationship building and looking at sites and considering the, you know, facility that would wrap around CounterPulse's programs. And then putting together this package, which included CounterPulse providing 10% of the resources needed as a sort of initial tenant contribution that got bundled into this tax credit deal and shopped. And then, you know, there was a basically a forgivable loan that's given on that. So it's all quite complicated, but the sort of the onset of the doors being open, so at the point of substantial completion, CounterPulse did sign a lease for 80 Turk Street and had a very highly subsidized lease payment that we were paying, which is essentially just to offset the cost of operating the building. So there was 80 Turk LLC and it's cast as a majority member and CounterPulse as a minority member, and we're leasing the building from 80 Turk LLC. Those lease payments aren't necessarily rent to own, but they were, you know, covering property insurance and the operations of the LLC and things like that. And so that started at the point of substantial completion, which was after this New Markets tax credit deal. So the real runway that CounterPulse had was more like 10 years. So we had to provide that, which for us ended up being about $1.3 million, this 10% that was our initial tenant contribution. I want to say my timeline document isn't in front of me right now, but around 2012, we weren't opening our doors until closer to 2015. And that's when our lease began with the trust model.
And so, Julie, giving yourself 10 years, how did, and then it also changes the narrative, right, of a traditional capital campaign for a nonprofit, especially for an arts nonprofit. How did the 10-year ramp, if you will, runway provide you and the CounterPulse team the opportunity to reach out to philanthropy, et cetera, to help raise the necessary money?
The real benefit was that there was a mix of urgency and time, actually. So there were these milestones that we needed to reach. So actually raising that first $1 million and change that we needed to get our seat at the table and provide our initial tenant contribution to kind of seal the deal, that represented more money than CounterPulse had ever raised cumulatively in the organization's history from individual sources or that kind of thing. So that was a big push just to even do that. And that was happening just like with a letter of intent and like a sparkle in our eye. You know, we're going to renovate this 10,000 square foot building down the Tenderloin with a real estate model none of you have ever heard about, has never been done before. And we're, you know, this like experimental grassroots arts organization. We swear it's going to work. It's amazing. So it took some real visioning, both on the part of the team, but also on the part of our, you know, philanthropic community to believe in us at that point. But we know we're like, we need to seal the deal. We need to secure our seat at the table for this incredible opportunity. So there was that urgency. And so we, you know, we have really solid foundation relationships as well as an individual donor who actually helped us make up that first $1 million. And then there was kind of a lull again, right? So then there's a little bit of time, like we break ground, we get the deal, we find the architects, we're, you know, in design, but we, you know, put this sort of series of phases into that 7-year period so that it doesn't just become this soup of like, we need $7 million eventually, you know? we made a series of deadlines around, you know, opening our doors, you know, having, you know, a substantial amount of the money raised by the time our doors are open, because a part of our capital campaign was the wasting endowment to launch programs. And one logic that really ended up working was get foundations who've never supported CounterPulse before, who are therefore very unlikely to give us a capital gift to buy a building, to get interested in our programs, come on as program supporters of this wasting endowment, launch a program, have a few years to prove to them that we're amazing and doing a good work, and then be able to ask them for that capital gift later. So these sort of like, you know, kind of staggered steps of relationship building, time to marinate, then another, you know, like another kind of benchmark that we can have some urgency around and raise another chunk of money. So that combination of time and urgency was really important given these milestones of the projects and needing to have certain benchmarks met along the way. So by the time we were opening our doors, of the $7 million, we had about six raised, actually. And that includes the tax credit in terms of how CounterPulse sees that whole $7 million, which was $1.3 million in and of itself. And so then there was the wasting endowment and the initial tenant contribution, and all of that's what makes up the total of $7 million. So we were really, you know, we really kicked off well and raised a bunch of money in the sort of first few years of the capital campaign. And then we were able to let things grow and simmer and build a track record and build the trust with our community and, you know, provide the proof that us being in the Tenderloin is a benefit to the city and to other sectors. Like, we started working with the Mayor's Office of Economic and Workforce Development, something we had never done before moving into the Tenderloin. So the time could get tricky, you know, because urgency in fundraising is a magic ingredient that we all know we either need to have or fabricate in some cases. So, you know, we were really sidelined, but then I think in the end sort of supported by the pandemic, actually, because that ended up being the last sort of 3 years of our 7-year compliance period. So we had intended to launch the final capital campaign, which is essentially the like fire the debt or like buy out the partner kind of logic of the capital campaign. And we had about $2.6 million left to raise. Some of that was like a replacement and maintenance reserve, just acknowledging that now you own the building, you have to take care of the building. But a big chunk of that, most of that was to complete what we needed to raise to actually write that check to CAST. So we, you know, we had intended to launch that at the kind of end of 2019, early 2020, and then the pandemic just came in and swept that all over. And so we weren't able to actually, you know, there was time. I mean, we all remember what that was like when I was like, I don't know if anybody's going to ever come back to theaters ever again. You know, it felt very up in the air. So we, you know, did some like thinking and planning and, you know, also just our own due diligence around, you know, this is our chance. We can exercise the option to purchase the building, but we also don't have to exercise that option. We can also be like, this has been an incredible 7 years. I hope this building goes to a great organization. We've outgrown it. Or there's exit clauses with the deal with CAPS and everything. So, but you know, when we did that evaluation, given the time that we had during the pandemic, we, you know, of course our commitment to the facility as well as the neighborhood was only renewed. And so we launched in the summer of 2021 with that benchmark of 2.6 million. And had essentially a year and change, maybe more like 18 months before the end of that, the sort of lease term with CAST, which was our first option to purchase. So again, there was this sense of urgency that we could leverage to get people like, it's time to buy the building now. Even though we've been here, I know you've been hearing this story for 10 years and a lot of people are like, wait, you didn't already buy the building? So that was the challenge of the length of time we had, is that a lot of people assumed that when we opened our doors, we had bought the building, because the messaging is confusing enough. But it's also even made more confusing by the fact that no one had ever done anything quite like this before. So even if you told them in what you thought was really clear language, oh no, well, CAST bought the building and now we have this compliance period, people would just be like, I've heard what I want to hear, which is CounterPulse bought their building. So it was a unique challenge to do the storytelling around the capital campaign and get the community to understand what we were doing and support it. And the time was really key for that in general. But I think the more important thing around the time was the building up CounterPulse's capacity to run and own a building. Cause that's the money to buy a building doesn't mean that you're prepared to have a building. And so even if we had been able to raise all 7 million in a year or two, we would be, you know, we're the 7 years we had to you know, I now have a dedicated sump pump contractor that I know and trust, you know, like building the capacity to own the building and the relationships like growing in the community that when we started, we didn't know everyone who would eventually end up helping us buy this building. We had to meet those people and prove ourselves to some of those people. So it's been a really inspiring journey for sure.
Well, I want to just hold on that point for 1 second, because this whole idea of having the scaffolding in place to be able to operate the building is a critical piece. And I think what CAST is discovering more and more is, I heard a joke years ago from a foundation officer that the fastest way to kill a nonprofit is to drop a building on them. And we're there to make sure that a nonprofit can't get crushed by the weight of the building. And what we're discovering as the portfolio of groups that we're helping grows is that because of the strength of having a portfolio, we have relationships with a broader and broader group of vendors. And suddenly we're discovering we can get wholesale insurance prices instead of retail and get lower costs of insurance and lower cost of vendors and bulk pricing and other benefits. So finding ways to bring the benefits of wholesale expenses to smaller nonprofits that would otherwise play retail, and bringing all of those relationships to build the scaffolding for the organization to then build their own capacity over time. And to some degree, we're available to continue on and continue with a small ownership interest to be able to bring our purchasing power to our partners as well, even afterwards. And I think that's really the essence of the model, is how to build partnerships so that no nonprofit gets crushed by a building or by the financial expenses and the inevitable surprises of owning a building.
Thank you, Josh, for that Wizard of Oz metaphor. That was really good. So, Julie, now that you own the building, how has that changed? And you really, I mean, part of working with CAST and through the whole process of raising the money, you actually own it outright. It's not like you have a mortgage or anything at this point on the building. Is that correct?
It's complicated, as you can imagine, actually. So, you know, the stability that CounterPulse has experienced really did start at the outset of opening our doors and having that highly subsidized lease, because the promise of being able to buy the building was there and the lease was very affordable. So it's, of course, destabilizing in terms of just the capacity that needs to go into fundraising. But, you know, that was still just like a part of a larger picture, which really, developed like a sense of longevity in place and planning and knowing that the horizon is long, which was new for me. You know, I took over CounterPulse when I was 29, actually. So I hadn't really had many horizons very long at all before that. So, you know, that represented a kind of an initial shift in the organizational culture in terms of how we think about ourselves as part of the city. And, you know, participating in other sectors in terms of our belonging to a neighborhood, these sorts of things started shifting then. And then in terms of the actual purchase of the building and having, you know, reached the top of the mountain and actually like succeeded in the fundraising, which, you know, we always felt confident about, but was, you know, it wasn't done until it was done. That really has been a pretty short period of time. Like, we really just closed on the building at the kind of turn of last year. We needed some time to work out, you know, operating agreements and all of that, because again, we're piloting something and there's no template that really applied to what we were outlining. So we're just really emerging into that new chapter of the organization where we own the building. We aren't raising a bunch of money and on that hustle and, you know, kind of trying that on. So it's been really exciting. And, you know, the financial implications are excellent. Like, the lease payment was low and affordable, but we don't have to make it anymore. So that's a savings to the organization. And then I think at present, like, what really feels notably different, and this is a bit like woo, touchy feely, but it feels like a spiritual change, like a sense of just ownership and belonging and sovereignty and just an inalienable like right to have space in the city for your programs and your community and your artists and what you do. And it's happening for me. And I also see it happening in the people who work at CounterPulse, both as artists and staff and board members, just a sense of Yeah, just like a kind of enlightening of a sense of purpose and direction and belonging that is so hard to find in the Bay Area in the real estate culture. You know, a lot of people don't own, it's, you know, like in many other cities, a lot of adult people at least own their home, you know, so they have that sense of, they've had that experience of being like, okay, this is something I own, but I'm also responsible for it. And in the Bay Area, a lot of the people who work at Counterpulse and are on the board and everything, a lot of them don't even own their own homes. So it's like this real sense of novelty to just try on that feeling of ownership. And so that's kind of percolating through. On a practical level, we also are creating multi-year projection tools and making depreciation plans and usable life surveys to figure out when we need the roof replaced and how long we would need to be saving up money to do that. And these sorts of, you know, just taking seriously the responsibility side of ownership. So, you know, right now that's sort of just percolating and we're literally creating the tools to start tracking some of those long range plans about the safeguarding and stewarding of the facility. But this kind of, yeah, this kind of spiritual or cultural development around belonging, you know, placekeeping, you know, it's like that tension between placemaking and placekeeping. It's like, we can't keep something if you don't already have it. Making is this idea of outstart, doing something, you know, it's like just that sense that we just need to like endure and that's what's radical about what Counterpulse is doing in this city is not changing, but enduring, you know, so it's been a really incredible, honestly, experience. And it's also quite interesting and enjoyable in a way to do these long range plans around a facility and the financial dimension of maturing an organization like Counterpulse to be ready for the responsibility of being a grown up and having a house. And, you know, we're in the middle of a strategic planning process that we plan that we ratified in 2021. So, you know, I've already been percolating on what I think will change in light of this, in light of the purchase. And when we renew in 2026 with that plan, I think that will be an interesting moment for us to really think about what changes in terms of our strategies and services and just like benefit, like how to better leverage the facility and the capacity of the organization to benefit our communities now that we aren't fundraising and aren't needing to do the like, you know, the big song and dance of fundraising takes a lot of work actually and takes a lot of capacity from an organization that we now have to redirect to other things that we do.
That's great. And would you say, Julie, just kind of following up on that, with this new phase and new stability, has that enabled Counterpulse to better support the artist community that makes up Counterpulse's ecosystem?
Yeah, well, it's like I always sort of try and shy away from the change narrative because I do really believe that just even the lease and the 7-year compliance period, that one of the most beneficial things that Counterpulse was able to experience was the privilege to not change, to keep up or meet a new lease term or take on a lease that's, you know, like we don't need to be like, okay, we need to get some productions in here that sell tickets. You know, that's something that our peers go through, you know, things change in their real estate reality and they need to change. They need to adapt. They need to become a rental house. They need to do less residencies. They, you know, and what's been really interesting about what Counterpulse has been able to do is just keep doing what we do for our communities. And that's really significant and of service instead of something that the community had come to know and appreciate and need going away because now Counterpulse is in this new building and it's too expensive now. It's like, nope, we just got to keep our hourly rental rates the same price. And if anything changed, we used to do one residency a year and now we do three because we have more space and more studios and, you know, this sort of thing. But we didn't have to raise our prices. We didn't have to change our outlook. We didn't have to become more commercially viable. You know, we're still predominantly supported through philanthropy. All of everything we do that's earned income that our artists pay to participate in is subsidized by grant or foundation support. And that's actually sustained. So, you know, I think being able to sustain those things, especially over the last 3 to 4 years, has been a distinct benefit. Like Counterpulse obviously had a moment of being shuttered and shut down. But even just the ability to, you know, really have site control, as they say, during the pandemic and decide when and how we would do things and what we could make available to our artist communities at different moments and, you know, state or city mandates around closures. like that itself really supported our community. And the fact that we had this relationship with CAPS and really had our own building gave us that sovereignty to do that even then. So it's, you know, I wouldn't say that CounterPulse hasn't been able to increase our benefit, but it's less important that it's increased as it is that it's the same. And that in a city such as San Francisco, that's so mercurial and changeable, to have an arts organization that supports innovators and creatives and independent artists and people focused on experimentation and intersecting art with activism and speaking truth to power, that an organization like that lived through the tech boom, lived through the pandemic, and just kept doing what we were doing, like, that's, I think, the really incredible story of CounterPulse over the last few years.
Welcome back to Voices of the Community, where we delve into critical issues facing Northern California communities. Voices of the Community is made possible by generous support from the Zeldebach Family Foundation, dedicated to ensuring vibrant work is created, new voices celebrated, and diverse communities have opportunities to thrive. Learn more at zff.org. We're also supported by the Peaceful World Foundation, fostering a culture of global peace through hosted conversations and education. Discover more at peacefulworldfoundation.org. Before we return to our dialogue with Julie and Josh, let's take a moment to explore an excerpt from our one-on-one interviews with Abasemic guests conducted by our roving reporters Issa Nakazawa and Eric Estrada. This segment offers deeper insights from artist and cultural worker Jason Wyman.
Hi, this is Issa Nakazawa with Voices of the Community, and we're here at Arts for a Better Bay Area Summit 2023. Thank you so much for talking to us. Can you just say your name? And if you're representing an arts org, say your org. And if not, just tell us a little bit about what you do.
Great. Hi, my name is Jason Wyman. I am an artist here in San Francisco. They, them pronouns. I have a business called Queerly Complex. That's part of the reason that I'm here today. And I also have an endeavor called Tree of Change Praxis, which I do with my dear business partner, Crystal Mason. And we've been doing change management and political education for housing rights organizations and for arts and culture organizations.
Wow, so many questions already. But the first that we're asking people is, how would you say the pandemic impacted the way that you're doing your work and the way that you're thinking about rebuilding or reactivating the arts community in San Francisco?
Well, I want to get away from the re, because we've always been activating our communities, even through the pandemic. So there is no re in reinvigorating, re-energizing the arts. The re in that is actually a misnomer, because it never ended. And it never was ever interrupted, actually. It changed. And I think that's the biggest thing, is that things changed during the pandemic. And we need to be ready to talk about that change very explicitly and stop having language that in a lot of ways erases history. That's also partly why I'm here, is to see what our arts advocacy organizations are actually saying, because I noticed that there weren't actually very many artists on the stage talking about arts and the state of it. So I'm here to listen and to find out exactly what our political leaders are saying, because right now we're in a moment of hyper-gentrification with our new housing element plan, the housing element, which is guiding all of our building in San Francisco for the next 8 years. So artists need to be more aware of the intersection of art, culture, and land ownership, not just land, but land ownership.
Thank you, Jason. That was so profound. And I do think there's so many ways that language shapes the way that we're understanding the problem before we even talk about potential solutions, right? Which people can get really fixated on. It's like, how are we even naming the issues that we're up against? Yes. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're noticing in terms of like the artist perspective being missing? Like, what do you think, how do you think the conversation is impacted when artists aren't in the space, whether it's like intentional or not?
I think, you know, there is a lot of artists have to hustle. So I don't want to put any of the onus on artists here, because we're all trying to navigate sticky situations, new economies, new ways of figuring out how we pay our rent, and all of the competing opportunities that are actually being presented to us. right now we are in a state where arts, the city has a narrative, a meta-narrative that's happening nationally and even globally about a doom loop, about violence and all of this other stuff. And it's scaring away conventions, it's scaring away business opportunities, but it's also scaring away tourists. And San Francisco, our lovely visitors bureau, sells San Francisco as an arts and culture town.
Right.
So arts and culture, especially even through our own propositions, is directly tied to the hotel industry and tourism. So right now, you know, all of these lovely opportunities are happening, and we have to be aware of how these lovely opportunities that are presenting themselves are disparate. They're a one-off thing here and a one-off thing here, and there's not a lot of coordination between all of these different initiatives, and thus the artists on the front end are having to do double, triple, quadruple the work trying to get into these opportunities. We actually need more streamlining of administration, and we need more political education of artists so that we can understand how to better advocate for ourselves versus relying on places like the opera or Grants for the Arts or the Arts Commission to be doing the advocacy on behalf of artists.
Yeah, a lot of the people I've talked to today have mentioned this like need for actual interdependence instead of the rhetoric of it. One of my last questions is, I also feel like oftentimes in moments like this, artists are used to cover up oftentimes gentrification. And so we do become kind of the gatekeepers or the interlocutors between like accelerated beautification efforts. And like we do kind of become the people who are in the middle, right?
Yeah.
Which has a degree of complicity, even if we are on survival mode. How do you navigate that? Or how do you kind of like find ways to be compassionate to yourself because you need to be an artist who's sustainable, but also have politics around what you're doing?
This is a really good question. I have a very concrete answer. So, you know, this last weekend was Pride Weekend.
Yeah.
And there was a fabulous People's March down Polk Street, which was the original parade route of our protest here in the city. And it ended at a beautiful event on Fern Alley. Fern Alley has the Fern Alley Music Series, and it is done by the Lower Polk Community Benefit District and Music City Events. And it was a wonderful time. I had a booth there myself. I really enjoyed myself. It was intergenerational. It was multiracial. We were doing interactive art making on Fern Alley. All of the things that we want to be doing, giving everything away for free, not charging money, right?
Wow.
So it was really beautiful and really lovely. The next morning I woke up and I started doing a little bit of digging around where some of the financing for these kinds of art fairs are coming, because I actually talked to some of the artists there, and you know, we're all struggling and we're trying to weigh, are these art fairs worth it or not?
Yeah,
do you know what I'm saying? And when I started looking in at the financing behind it, there was a $2 million investment by the same man who has been trying to get surveillance cameras all over San Francisco.
Great example.
Exactly. So for me, I'm looking at this and I'm like, this is a wonderful opportunity. I was able to do all of the things that I wanted to do in the way that I wanted to do them. And also, I know that my involvement here is adding value to literally a gentrification project. Like, not kind of, it's a literal investment by a gentrifier, by a tech gentrifier into art things. So for me, I am working on actually writing about that, not shying away from the complications of it, and instead trying to be open about the fact that this is going on, and then asking my other artists, what are you noticing? How are you navigating it? Not judging people about it, but saying, here's what I'm noticing. It's making me feel icky. I don't know what to do about it. What are you doing about it? And I think that is, we need to be honest about how we are and are not contributing to a system, because we all are contributing to systems.
And if people wanted to stay in touch with you, how could they find you or your work?
There are two places you can find me. One is queerlycomplex.com. I'm also queerlycomplex on all social media, queerlycomplex.com. You can also find my other work with Crystal Mason at treeofchange.net. That's treeofchange.net.
Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, Jason. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's rejoin our discussion with Julie Phelps, Artistic and Executive Director of CounterPulse, and Joshua Simon, Senior Advisor at the Community Arts Stabilization Trust, as they offer invaluable perspectives on their collaborative journey, revealing the intricacies of how they orchestrated CounterPulse's successful acquisition of its performance space.
Wonderful insights. So Josh, coming back to you, CounterPulse was one of the two pilots, right, at the time that you're putting all this together. Over the decade, how has CASP been able to leverage this pilot program, this experimental real estate model in the San Francisco Bay Area, as well as have other cities, counties, countries adopted the model?
Yes, it's been an amazing journey, both as a board member and now as their senior advisor. The model has grown and evolved. We're discovering, as I mentioned earlier, the value of scale. And because of that, we're looking at, are there problems in terms of space that can be solved with more scale? So we're currently working with a number of artists who have been in the community at Pier 70 in San Francisco in the Dog Patch neighborhood for many years, and working with the developer there to see if the affordability of that community can continue by expanding the community and having a bigger complex. And in that case, CAST would be a long-term operator of the facility, possibly. So that's one possibility we're looking at. We're working with the Black Cultural Zone in Oakland, which is creating a Liberation Park, which is a culture and arts-based community development effort, being an anchor and a hub for arts and cultural organizations to be able to strengthen and be a base for economic development in the East Oakland neighborhood. We're working to strengthen the ecology of arts organizations, working in partnership with Oakstop, which is an organization that rents space to arts and cultural organizations for events and long-term, trying to figure out ways that we can work with individual artists. So we're looking at a number of different models and looking for ways that we can steward facilities. In particular, we're now looking at ground floor space based on, in part, the success the CounterPulse has had. As retail moves to the internet, how do we work with organizations and owners to activate the ground floor space in ways that have long-term viability and that help to bring people back downtown and create places for people to gather again and for people to connect across the various issues that we need to gather around. So that work has attracted a lot of attention around the planet, actually. And we've been asked to talk in Austin and Denver, Seattle, Vancouver, and there was an effort to replicate what we're doing in London. So there's really work around the world looking at how to take this model and how to sort of create a partner to provide the scaffolding to make sure that organizations can support the space they need.
Great. So I'm going to ask each of you to just share with the audience some of the things that you've learned in this process, in this pilot, and what are some of the things that you would recommend for local cities and governments to support this new creative real estate model for more arts organizations to be able to purchase their building. So Julie, in your process, what do you feel like you and the CounterPulse team have learned, and what are some of the recommendations or requests that you would have?
Yeah, well, going back to the beginning where Josh mentioned that real estate development and renovation projects are not for the faint of heart, I think the very first thing that I always do recommend when people ask me for advice on if they should buy a building or how they should buy a building is, first, really think about if you need to own a building. Is having your own space and owning your own building a significant addition to what you as a nonprofit or charitable organization are doing for your communities? And if your answer to that is no, then there's a lot of other models that could be a better fit for people. And even CAST has, of course, this is sort of like the initiative model that CAST was launched on, but has taken on serving as a, long-term leaseholder that sublets to smaller nonprofits and can still take care of some of the facilities management and overhead stuff that a lot of small companies don't want to build the capacity to do. And so there's options, and ownership, you know, has a particular fetish. And I think the US American context in particular as the sort of only way to have really made it as a person or organization. But if you look more broadly across the globe, there's a lot of real estate models that work. What doesn't work is feeling completely destabilized in your real estate, but there's more than one solution to that problem, and ownership is not the only one. So that's the first thing I always recommend. And, you know, having a distinct and compelling vision for space for your organization and for your community, and having, you know, an actual site that is compelling and fits, like the fit for your organization is really key. A dimension that was really important for us deciding to purchase the building here in the Tenderloin is that we had just, you know, we were at the end of our lease in Sonoma. We were busting at the seams of that building. We had approached Community Vision to do a facility strategic plan to identify what is our ideal facility. And, you know, we had a list of things that we knew we wanted. You know, we wanted to have a standalone building so that we could have amplified music without having issues with neighbors. And we wanted to be in a commercial district, and we wanted X number of square feet. And so, you know, identify what you're actually talking about, and don't leave it in this abstract idea of like, we just want to own our own home. It's like, get specific. Is it ownership? When you say home, what do you mean? What are the actual specifications of the building that would serve you best? And then if you can't find that building, then, you know, you need to start iterating your vision until you get to something that makes sense. Because there's a way in which this was the pilot. It was a huge success. It went really well. A lot of stars aligned that is hard to fully comprehend unless you were there in the early days of launching this model. Like the Counterpulse and our commitment to serving communities and the location in the Tenderloin, and then this, you know, former cabaret theater that was available, you know, one half block from a BART station. And, you know, like, and then the trust and the relationships on top of all of that, you know, and then of course, then the fundraising started, you know, so don't go headlong into it out of a kind of romantic notion to own a building. Make sure you really know what you mean and, you know, what would really solve the issues that you're thinking you need to solve by thinking you need to own. And that may lead you to the same decision. You may really want to own a building, but make sure to just like really unpack it and make it concrete before jumping to this, because it is very, very difficult. I joke sometimes that if I hadn't been 29 and single, like there's no way. So, and it's a joke, but I actually also like think that I'm serious. So it's a lot of work, and it was a lot of work, and it's totally worth it, but it's only worth it if it's actually the right thing for you. So just make sure to get clear on that first, you know? And yeah, once you have that clear vision, that's also what underwrites all the rest of the success. Like once you have a clear vision of what you're doing, why you're doing, and are like really confident and can stand behind this being the right thing for your organization, the rest of it falls into place. It's like a lot of things in life, you know, like if you keep hitting roadblocks, a good thing to ask, because you're the least common denominator in all those roadblocks, like why isn't this lining up, you know? And it may just be that it's not the right fit, you know, you've been pursuing the wrong goal. So yeah, I don't know if that's too dire or not inspirational enough, but it's, you know, it can be the right thing for people, and it's not always.
If I can lift up something you said, Julie, this idea of real estate readiness, Community Vision has a great real estate readiness training program, which I'd recommend people to take a look at. But what that means is real estate is just a wrapper that holds an activity, and that wrapper has a cost, and the activity has a cost. And so the activity is supported by a cash flow, and the cash flow is either enough to support the activity and the wrapper, or it's not. That cash flow has to be sustainable. So you have to be able to project that it's going to be sustainable for long enough to sustain the activity and the wrapper. If you start out with a building without the activity being clear, it collapses. So being real estate ready means that you understand how the cash flow is enough to be able to support the activity and the building it wraps. If the building's too big for the activity, you'll still get crushed by the expense of that. So that real estate readiness is, I think, the critical piece of this whole adventure. And we work with Community Vision to try and make sure that our organizations are real estate ready. And I think there's a lot more innovation that can happen with government for those organizations that are, because we live in a very unique time. I have never in 45 years in this business heard of the owners of large downtown buildings giving their buildings back to the bank. Most recently, the San Francisco Center, which in the 90s was the most valuable real estate in the United States, was given back to the bank. That we have not lived in times like this, when because of retail going back to the area and office workers not coming back downtown, buildings aren't, people aren't gathering and buildings aren't worth what they were. And cities are struggling with what's the relevance of gathering in urban areas. And the arts are critical. Arts and cultural activities are critical components for gathering. So now is the time to work with our policymakers to look at what tax benefits can we be looking at, what incentives, what permit expediting and other measures can be taken to reactivate our downtowns with organizations like CounterPulse and anchor those organizations as foundations for healthy, multicultural cities. And for gathering places where we can gather across all of our differences and have the critical conversations that we need as a country to come back together.
That's wonderful. And Josh, any other suggestions, or Julie, any other suggestions for, you know, cities or counties or countries that are out there that want to foster, you know, this type of a program to support their arts and culture sectors?
Well, I mean, speaking not to the arts leader folks, but more of the, you know, people designing urban centers, tackling issues of vacancies in their own city centers around the world, is that the arts are a really incredible sector in a city. And if you don't already think of it that way, you should start. The jobs we create per dollar, the stats are out there, the way we bring people together in when other businesses, you know, their workers won't even come back to the office and people will come to a small independent theater venue. Just really valuing what arts can do for center cities and how important it is to resource theater organizations, live arts organizations, but arts organizations in general with space, because we need it. We know what to do with it. And what we create with space in cities is so invaluable in creating diverse, vibrant, but also economically stable arts organizations. Not always sometimes super huge what the arts are doing, but it's deep. The roots that we have in the community and therefore the resilience that we have to live through booms and busts and pandemics and continue to serve the community, continue to drive foot traffic, continue to create economic opportunities for local people to have jobs and work and express themselves is just incredible. And so if you're struggling with a storefront or, you know, a vacancy, or just remember to think about the arts. Like, yes, think about retail. Yes, think about restaurants. We, you know, we know that those things are things that are needed in downtown neighborhoods or cities in general. But just make sure to think about the arts, and not just commercial arts, but independent, grassroots, community-based arts organizations.
I'd like to go one step beyond that, Julie, in that the creative economy is 7% of the California economy. The California economy is the fourth largest on the planet. Arts and culture are critical economically. And beyond that, arts and culture are critical for healthy neighborhoods and bringing together low-income communities. The Hospitality House Arts Program in San Francisco has been a critical piece for many homeless people to stabilize and build hope and be able to rebuild their lives. Many programs like this are critical for people to be able to address their homeless situation, to address their economic situation, and to just build hope in difficult times which is a foundation for economic renewal and for personal growth. So I don't see this as, I see this as something that's critical to look at from a policy standpoint. What is the arts component of every city? What is the cultural zone? And how do we put resources behind those cultural zones, whether it's tax abatement or tax credits or just outright funding? California eliminated redevelopment many years ago, and we have yet to find a tool for reinvesting in our cities. I think it's a critical time to find ways to reinvest in our cities, whether it's through the enhanced infrastructure finance districts or other finance tools that can be used to reinvest in ourselves. At the end of the day, if we don't invest, there's no place, no reasons to gather. And as gathering becomes less and less of a priority, the conversations that hold our society together don't happen. So I could go on in terms of specific, and don't get me nerding out on tax credit tools. So we'll take all day, but love to talk to any of your audience members in the future about how we can incentivize places to gather.
Wonderful. What a great conversation. I'm so glad I gathered you. Took a while to get us all together, but a really great conversation, and I appreciate that. So I want to thank both Julie and Josh for sharing their and their organization's work to support our arts and culture sector and creative workforce. We'll make sure that our viewers and listeners have your contact information, your websites and social media so they can get engaged and support all of your work to support our arts and arts culture organizations, especially as we continue to work our way on the other side of the COVID-19 pandemic. So Julie and Josh, thanks so much for being back on Voices of the Community.
Thank you for having us.
And with that, we've reached the conclusion of another illuminating episode of Voices of the Community. Today, we've had the privilege of hearing from Julie Phelps, Artistic and Executive Director of ContraPulse, and Joshua Simon, Senior Advisor at the Community Arts Stabilization Trust. Together, they've guided us through the innovative real estate model that empowered ContraPulse to secure its space, highlighting its potential to enrich arts communities nationwide. To learn more about our guests and their organizations, programs, services, volunteer opportunities, and how to support their cause with a donation, visit voicesofthecommunity.com. Click on the link to the Arts and Culture series and find Episode 9. You can also hear more from Julie about nonprofit board governance in Episode 1 of this series, and more from Josh about building affordable housing for our creative workforce in Episode 4 of this series. Today's episode was made possible through a special co-production partnership with Arts for a Better Bay Area for their State of the Arts Summit on June 28, 2023. We extend our heartfelt thanks to our incredible technical crew, including the audio and video wizard and our associate producer, Eric Estrada. Additionally, we'd like to express our gratitude to our esteemed co-production partner, Bayback Media, and their dedicated staff, Paula Argoni, Andy Konami, Issa Nakazawa, and Javon Giles. And let's not forget the graphics magic skillfully crafted by Casey Nance from Citron Studios. We extend our sincere gratitude to our valued broadcast partners who help bring Voices of the Community to the airwaves. Thank you to KSFP LP-FM, broadcasting on 102.5 FM in San Francisco, and KPCA LP-FM, airing on 103.3 FM in Petaluma. We're also grateful for the support of Petaluma Community Access TV and Bayback Media's SF Commons Public Access TV channels 29 and 76. Their partnership ensures that our discussions reach a wider audience, sparking meaningful conversations and fostering community engagement. Thank you for your continued support and commitment to amplifying diverse voices and perspectives. Voices of the Community is made possible by generous support from the Zillaback Family Foundation, dedicated to ensuring vibrant work is created, new voices celebrated, and diverse communities have opportunities to thrive. Learn more at zff.org. We're also supported by the Peaceful World Foundation, fostering a culture of global peace through hosted conversations and education. Discover more at peacefulworldfoundation.org. Take us along on your next walk, workout, or drive by subscribing to Voices of the Community on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast. And if you've been enjoying the show, please take a moment to leave us a rating and review on the podcast platform of your choice. Your feedback helps us improve and reach more listeners. To
To watch past and future episodes of Voices of the Community, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Simply visit youtube.com and search for Geo Koster. We value your input and ideas. Reach out to us by sending an email to george@georgekoster.com. We would love to hear from you. I'm George Koster from San Francisco, and on behalf of our entire team, thank you for joining us on this journey of exploration and dialogue. Until next time, remember, your voice matters.